Our first guest today is an award-winning journalist and author, and is here to tell us about her latest book, which is called Self-Contained, Scenes from a Single Life. Welcome to the show, Emma John.
Hi, Sabina.
Hi, Emma. So, is this your life story then? Are you single?
I am single. I mean, it's not my whole life story, because I might not be single forever.
Of course not, no.
You don't know what's around the corner.
What made you write it then? I mean, there are a lot of singletons out there, but I read a phrase of yours, which I think is great. Romance will arrive when you least expect it, but you had assumed it would also make its own travel arrangements.
Well, I think that sort of sums up why I wrote it, really. I think I have a lot of female friends. I've got a lot of single male friends as well, but I think for women, it quite often tends to have more of a stigma attached to it to be single. And it's not that I'm, you know, it's not that I'm sort of determinedly single. This isn't a manifesto for singleness. I'm a massive romantic at heart. But I just happen to know that, you know, I'd reached 40 without having found a partner and, you know, settled down, to use that terrible term. And it's a very different life, because you can end up thinking that you're waiting for something to happen and that you're sort of living in a limbo until it does, because for so much of our life, we're sort of imbued with this idea that really the mark of adulthood is, you know, settling down and creating a family of your own.
Yeah, yeah.
So if that doesn't happen to you, who are you really? How do you define yourself? And how do you stop defining yourself as somebody who's missing out on something, somebody who's got a lack of something, somebody who's failed in some way? I think there's still that attachment of failure to women who don't find a partner.
And there is also a difficulty for women when they do hit their 40s as well, because one's biological clock is ticking, isn't it? Do you want children?
Well, you see, that's another interesting thing, is that I think in some ways I've been incredibly fortunate in that I have never felt desperate to be a mother. It's one of the things you get told, isn't it? You know, you'll want them when you find the right person.
Yeah.
Or you know, and if you sort of say, "Oh, well, I'm not really kind of that keen on children," as you know, to hang out with, people say to you, "Oh, it's different when they're your own." So again, you know, these are sort of truisms that I've been told, and I've never second guessed them. I've never questioned them, because that's just, you know, the way that life is. And certainly becoming an aunt definitely changed, you know, a lot of the way I felt and a lot of the feelings that I was able to have towards children.
It's a lot easier than being an aunt.
And that's the other thing, is that, you know, I actually adore being an aunt. I have a 4-year-old niece and a nearly 2-year-old nephew, an 18-month-year-old nephew. And that has been an incredible, you know, new experience in my life, and they're an absolute joy. But it hasn't made me broody, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah, well, yeah, at least you know. I mean, there's nobody has to be broody, nobody has to want children, but it's a good learning curve, because at least you know now.
Yeah, and I think that it's another one of the reasons why I felt very fortunate that throughout my 20s and 30s, you know, I mean, although I had boyfriends and dated along the way, but the fact that I never found a kind of serious partner, I was never afraid. And I think that's the thing that we put on single women. We make huge assumptions that they must be feeling sad, they must be feeling lonely, they must be feeling afraid that they're not going to find anybody, or afraid that they're not going to have a family. And I just never really encountered that fear until I got close to 40. And the fear was, well, I actually might not find somebody. And if I don't, that means I'm a spinster. And it was really the fear of the word spinster and what that meant that was much more sort of punishing to me than anything I'd experienced before.
Yeah, I'll be totally honest with you though, Emma, that you're thinking from your point of view, but I honestly don't feel like that. I have some friends that are single and I'm full of admiration for them. They're strong, they're independent women. You know, when they find the one, or if they find the one, then that'll be right. They're not going to settle for second best. I think it's great. I don't think everybody stereotypes single women at all.
No, I think that's probably true, but I think what happens for women themselves is that because you grow up with the narrative that you're going to find somebody, and that is a big part of life, you internalize a lot of these expectations and feelings. And so then when you are caught in those very awkward conversations, and we've all had them, you know, the awkward small talk where, you know, just for something to say that the person you've just met says, and, you know, well, and are you here with anyone, or, you know, are you married, or whatever it is, and you say no, and the room goes a little bit quiet because nobody knows what to say next. And there's a huge, you know, there's a lovely sensitivity around it. You know, I've certainly never felt, I've never felt laughed at in any way. You know, it's not like I'm kind of living in the Victorian era where, you know, it was almost like a disgusting thing to be a spinster. But it's certainly, you know, I've certainly sort of internalized a lot of the idea that it is that it's a failure, because, you know, it's something that everybody else has managed to do, you haven't.
That's terrible. Do you surround yourself with other single people?
Oh yeah, and I've got wonderful friends, and I think again one of the things I write about in the book that sort of has been the most important thing that's happened to me in the last decade of my life certainly has been really finding a community who live close to me, and a community of friends that are like both geographically nearby as well as being emotionally close, because you do need. You do need to feel like you have family around you, and that you have support, and that, you know, you belong somewhere, that you belong, and that, you know, if you wake up feeling a bit sick tomorrow, somebody's going to be.
Yeah, true.
And that's been, you know, one of the greatest joys of my life has been finding that.
Yeah, you do take it for granted when you're in a relationship that exactly that. I'm just thinking, you know, if I don't feel too good, then my husband will look after me. So I get you there. But I think there are two types of, or probably many types of singletons, because I think if you've just come out of a relationship, that can be quite bad. I remember many years ago when I first got divorced from my first husband, and everybody has to pick a side. And all of a sudden I stopped getting invited to couples meals.
Yes, and for me the harder thing was that you go through this pattern of abandonment really when you're a single person, and it's nobody's fault, and it's just the way of the world. But you know, from the moment that you're starting to live your grown-up life in your maybe early 20s, the people who you're closest to, you may have a wonderful gang of friends, and I certainly did coming out of university, but the more they will eventually, most of them will eventually find a partner and settle down, and then create their own little miniature community and nuclear family. Many of them, you know, I live in London, so I live in a capital city. It's a place where people come for a while, and then when they have their family, they move out to somewhere with
somewhere
more
with
green
the garden,
space.
Yeah.
and you know, it really took me a long while to really realise that actually that's a succession of heartbreak that you have to go through. And you shrug them off because that's what life is, and you've got to get on with things. But that is a big part of single life that we don't kind of perhaps think about and consider as a kind of, wow, yeah, there's kind of quite a lot of small elements of grief you have to go through.
Yes, yeah, I can understand that. Yeah, people sort of dipping in and out of your life. Yeah. Is it harder nowadays or easier? I mean, you're a lot younger than me anyway, but with all the dating apps, does that make it easier to find somebody?
Well, I mean, I can't answer to that because it hasn't done for me. But what I would say, it's certainly, you know, it definitely is a wonderful, you know, it's wonderful that you can basically get a date. Whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever circumstance you're in, you can find a date. You could probably find multiple dates every day if that's what you wanted. And what I think people are coming to realize now is that finding dates in that way is not the same as finding a companion for the rest of your life. And that actually the tyranny of choice, as we all know, when we've all done it, standing in the supermarket and feeling completely overwhelmed by the number of different brands of pasta or whatever it is, that tyranny of choice is it can be paralyzing on dating apps. And I've certainly I write in the book about my experience of internet dating, which began before we had apps. So, you know, this was the days when you had to still do the very long and involved filling in of questionnaires.
Instead of swiping
profiles.
Right and left. Yeah.
And selling yourself and, you know, with all your best selfies and all the rest of it. But my experience of that has been just that it was like you had to invest a lot of time and it was like dating almost had to become, in fact, people said this to me. If I said I wasn't enjoying it or I wasn't really getting anywhere with it, people would say, well, you know, you've got to take it seriously. I mean, you've got to almost treat it like a hobby. Wow. And I just thought, my life is too short. I have lots of hobbies.
Yeah.
Don't really need this.
I've got to ask you, though, Emma, because you are a sports journalist. Don't you meet any honky sportsmen during your job?
Oh, I mean that. I do meet a lot of attractive sportsmen, but it would feel incredibly unprofessional to proposition any of them.
And how do you feel about propositioning men? Is it okay in this day and age, or are you a bit old fashioned and you want the man to proposition you?
Oh, definitely. I mean, yeah. You know, I mean, I would be happy either way, but like, of course it's fine. And I actually, there's a story I tell in the book about this wonderful friendship I had with a man. Because this is the other thing that I really love about my life is that I've got lots of fantastic male friendships. And, and at one stage I thought to myself, I wonder whether I discount, you know, I discount the romantic possibilities of these male friendships, you know. And I'd spent quite a long time getting to know this guy and I'd started to think, well, maybe there could be something there. And maybe, you know, maybe it is really important to like take the bold step and, act on that chemistry and ask somebody out. And it really was like, it wasn't the first time I'd asked anybody out, but it was the first time I'd ever done it, over text, having absolutely no idea, you know, what the result would be. And I felt incredibly proud of myself and incredibly mature and grown up that, you know, I wasn't afraid of rejection and all the rest of it. And then he said, no, thank you. He wasn't really interested. And actually he got so embarrassed that was the end of our beautiful friendship.
Oh no. And how does that feel? I mean, the rejection, I couldn't cope with that.
I mean, it did sing. It sung for a little while. But, you know, that's one of the joys. That's one of the things I love about writing is that, you know, I can write that as a chapter in my book and I can, you know, and I can really exorcise it with humour. And it makes me feel a lot better.
Brilliant. Well done you. Well done you. Now, I was looking at your website and this is not your first book. What are your other couple of books that you've written?
Well, like you said, I was a sports writer. I am a sports writer, and my very first book was I wrote about the terrible England cricket team of the 1990s, and in particular, my teenage obsession with them. That book was called Following On, and having written about, you know, my teenage obsession, I then during my 30s I became really obsessed with bluegrass music, and I actually, having grown up as a classically trained violinist. And then having put my violin aside and not played at all for about 10 years, I decided that what I really wanted to do was just jump on a plane, go to North Carolina, live there for a year, and immerse myself in the weird and wacky world of bluegrass jams. and try and become a true American South.
Wow! Did you do it then? Did you succeed?
I got some of the way that I actually, you know, I did have a couple of really wonderful musical epiphanies where, and I ended up, I was always playing with brilliant people, because that's the thing I loved about the music, is that the talent pool, you know, in the middle of the mountains where there's nobody to hear, the levels of musicianship are absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
And it's just it's a wonderful thing to have got to have been a part of. And that, so I wrote that up as a book, and that was called Wayfaring Stranger, and it was just it's just named Travel Book of the Year.
Oh, well done. Congratulations. Well, our listeners can find out more about Emma and her books from the website, which is emmajohn.net. We are selling this book on our website, tre.radio. It's called Self-Contained, Scenes from a Single Life, and it's by Emma John, who we are chatting to now. Emma, it's been a breath of fresh air. Thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Thanks, Selena.
Take care. And good luck. And let us know if you meet someone, your forever partner.
I will do.
But don't just settle. Bye-bye.